Well, I call your attention to a familiar chapter. We're more familiar with the latter part of the chapter than we are the first, but we're going to be in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16, this evening, but we're going to look at the first part. We're going to look at really one of the least known of the parables. It is a parable that is sometimes difficult for people to understand. I don't think that somebody that's been saved 3 months is going to really be able to grasp it. But with the crowd that we've got here tonight, probably so. Now, parables, of course, Jesus told them all the time, stock and trade of what he did. He told this because it would be where that the believers would be able to understand, but the unbelievers would not. Why was that? Because they had rejected his messiahship. They had rejected him being the king of the Jews. And so because of that rejection, he began to speak in parables to them, but those that were the disciples, not just the 12, but someone that was a disciple, they would be able to at least understand when the explanation was given. Now, last week, the last thing that we talked about was that there was a brother that said that, or the father said to the older brother, you ought to be glad that your brother who was lost is found and who was dead is now alive. When you come to verse number 1 of chapter 16, it goes right into it and it says, and he said also unto his disciples, there is no time lapse between those two chapters. So in other words, what we saw last week and what we're going to hear tonight is really a continuation of the same time frame. And so he is talking to all of these people, they're hearing this parable, and then he says to his disciples. Now, we know that the Pharisees are still listening. There are times when I have heard people's conversation, there's times when people have heard my conversation and I was not sitting at the same table. I know that you probably have done the same thing. Years ago, there was some kind of a comedy where there were two guys and they were talking about a horse race, and they knew that it was going to be a lock if they bet on this. And the guy that's got his back to their booth, but he's right next to them, he hears them talking about, yep, I'm telling you right now, this is a tip that you need to act on, man. And they're talking to each other. He's listening. And the next thing you know, what it was he goes and he bets a bunch of money on it. But the problem was these two guys knew that he was listening. And so they just played right along with it. And so these Pharisees are listening. Look at verse 14. We're not going to spend time here right now. But I just want you to see this. And the Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things. And so they have heard what Jesus has been telling, and now they're listening to what he is about to tell them in our portion of Scripture tonight. Now, this is a difficult parable. I mentioned to you that it's one of the least known because it's hard to understand, and so people don't spend much time on it. Great preacher from many, many years ago, J.C. Ryle. If you ever come across the book by J.C. Ryle in some used bookstore somewhere, you ought to buy it. Great, great preacher from years gone by. In J.C. Ryle's writing, in his commentary on this, he said there were no less than 16 different interpretations of this parable. I want us to just take it for what it says. I don't want us to read a whole lot into it as far as, well, this is representing this and this is representing that. I just want us to just read it and just see what it says, and see if it doesn't make sense when we get to the end of it. And so, Ryle, 16 interpretations. Let's go for just one that we can grab tonight, okay? Now, it's not an evangelistic parable. It's basically about how to live our lives. And so we see that they're listening. Now, what does the word steward mean? It has the idea of someone that is a manager. That person manages somebody else's assets. I'll give you an example. We're not going to turn to it, but you'll know this story. Genesis. Toward the end of the book of Genesis, that is the life of Joseph. We know that Joseph, when he was a young man, his father doted upon him and gave him a coat of many colors. Brothers got ticked off about it. They put him in a well. Then a caravan comes along. They pull him out of the well, sell him into slavery. He is sold into slavery. He's bought by a man named Potiphar. He does so well, everything that the boy touches turns to gold. Potiphar says, I want you to be a manager or a steward of my home. Well, that means he had access to everything. He had access to the finances. He had access to telling the servants what to do. He had access to the livestock. He had access to everything. And Potiphar's wife even wanted him to have access to her, and he said no. Well, then Potiphar is told by his wife, that Hebrew tried to have his way with me, which was not true. But Potiphar, probably to save face, he takes him, puts him back into prison. He comes out of prison and gives an interpretation of a dream. And so what do we see? Every time he was doing something, whether it was Potiphar's house or in Egypt, he had access to everything as a steward. He was the one that was managing everything that either Potiphar or Pharaoh had in their possession. And so here we find that this man is putting the manager as a steward in charge of what he has. Now, the Bible tells us in several places, and we're going to look at these because I want you to understand that you and I are to be stewards. I want you to look with me at 1 Corinthians 4, and we will look at verse 1 and 2. Let a man so account of us. So in other words, Paul is speaking to the Corinthians, and he says, let you people that are there in Corinth give a reckoning of us, talking about the guys on his evangelistic mission team, as of the ministers or stewards of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. So in other words, he was a steward of the mysteries of God. Yesterday, Miss Sandra sent me a video of Dr. Hudson back in 1994. He was already sick, and he was preaching somewhere, and they videotaped it, and he was trying his best to sing, I'm on the winning side. He couldn't remember all the words, but he was having a good time singing it. And I remember the night, and I thought about this with this message, I remember the night that Dr. Hudson preached on stewards of the mysteries of God at Forest Hills in Decatur, back in 76. If it wasn't 76, it was early 77. And it was a Sunday night. He had had a long day. He had been up a lot on Saturday night because of the message that he was preaching. But he was talking about being a steward of the mysteries of God. And one of the mysteries of God is how that Christ dwells in us and we have a dual nature. And he got to talking about how that we had the Holy Spirit that lives inside of us, and now that we have the sin nature that lives inside of us. And in that sermon, and this is the thing that I took away from it, he talked about how that you're sitting at a place and the background music's going, and there's something on the inside when it's some crazy song, And there's Spirit of God going, I don't like that. I don't like that. And he said, and then all of a sudden, the flesh pipes up and goes, I like that. I like that right now. And then the next thing you know, he went into doing ham bone. I don't know how he does it, how you hit your leg and hit your chest and all of that, but he's going, ham bone, where you been? Around the world and going again. And I remember that as a young preacher, and I'm thinking, that is crazy. But I'm telling you, I remember that, and I remember that sermon. I've got that sermon somewhere on a cassette tape, or as Brother Edgar Thomas used to say, a cassette tape, right? And so you've got that mystery of God that we're a steward of. And so we're stewards of those mysteries. Look with me at verse number 2. Moreover, it is required in stewards, in me and you, that a man be found faithful. In other words, every day we get up knowing that we are a manager of what God has entrusted to us. And so we try to do it to the best of our abilities, to the glory of God. It's all his anyway. I hope you realize that. The house you live in really belongs to God. The car you drive really belongs to God. The bank account that you have might have your name on it, but it's really God's. He can get it whenever he wants it. I want you to look at Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Now listen to this, the world and they, that's people, that dwell therein. We belong to God. We have been bought with a price. What is that price? The precious blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. One final verse, look at 1 Peter chapter 4, verse number 10. And as every man hath received the gift, even so minister the same one to another as good stewards, good managers of the manifold grace of God. Now, I don't know what your definition of a manifold is, but a manifold in my thinking is basically it's a part, and it could be on an automobile. It could be on an irrigation system. Manifolds come in a lot of different applications. But what it does is it has one input, and it has many exports. When you think about the grace of God, how that it comes into our lives, and it talks about the manifold grace of God, all I'm thinking about is that God gives us grace in many different ways. I mean, he gives us grace when we are driving. He gives us grace when we are sleeping. He gives us grace when we are eating. I mean, the grace of God is always abounding with blessings. Sometimes those blessings come in the form of mercies. On Monday, Debbie and I drove down to be at the surgery for Miss Brenda, and as we were going through Monticello, I don't know why my phone took us this way. It was foggy. It was two-lane roads, and I mean we're going down, and I mean we're old. We don't see good. We don't hear good. And we're coming through Monticello, and all of a sudden, some lunatic has a 16-foot trailer, and he's got out of his truck to go eat breakfast. There's a little breakfast joint that there, right at the outskirts of Monticello, or if you're uppity, it's Monticello. But Monticello, and I guarantee you, the back end of that trailer was that far out into the road. And I saw it at the last minute. And I mean, all day long, I was thanking God for his protection for us. When I think of the grace of God, I think about that. And so if God is pouring that grace into us, that manifold grace of God, and it's coming out, that is to bless others and minister the same type of thing one to another. And so we see that we're stewards and that we have the job of being a manager. Now, this manager is not the type that we want to be. I don't know if anything, any one of the people that is in this story has got anything good about them. I don't think so. You say, well, what about that Lord that's there? We'll get to that in just a moment. But the first thing that I want you to see this evening is I want you to see the accusation. Look at verse 1 and 2. There was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused. What was he accused of? That he had wasted his goods. The word wasted is the word that we had last week when it talked about the prodigal went and wasted his goods on, or his inheritance on riotous living. That is the exact same word. So last week we had a prodigal son. Tonight we have a prodigal manager or a prodigal steward. And so he had wasted this certain rich man's goods, and he, the rich man, called him, the manager, and said unto him, how is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest no longer be steward. In other words, you are not going to be in charge of my things any longer. Now, dishonesty is all the way through this parable. I think that in the world, there's a lot of dishonesty that is out there. Now, what is most likely happened? Well, I don't necessarily think that this guy was embezzling money. I think that he was wasting money. I think that he was maybe padding his expense account. He might have been adding a little bit to the tally, which we'll get to in a moment, just so that he could kind of skim it off the top. It was not something that the owner had originally priced it at, but he added to it, and then he was kind of taking it and kind of taking a few dollars here, a few dollars there. And so probably not, you know, full-fledged white-collar crime, but he was taking what was not his, and he got caught. And so the accusation that came, we don't have any idea where it came from. Perhaps it came from somebody that worked there. And they thought, if I can get rid of this guy, I can get that job. That's kind of what I'm thinking, because how would anybody else know unless they had the inside skinny? And so accusations are very common in the world. I mean, all you got to do is just turn on some political channel, and I mean, the Democrats accuse the Republicans of this, and Republicans accuse the Democrats of this, and the Independents accuse everybody of everything. I mean, you got accusations all over the place. You got the president making accusations, you got senators making accusations, and congressmen making accusations. Accusations are everywhere. Elon did this, Zuckerberg did that, it's everywhere. The place that it should not be is with the people of God. We ought to make sure that what we say is accurate, and we should not spread falsehoods, but the world doesn't care. Absolutely does not care. How many of you remember the guy that was the majority speaker from Nevada? His name was Harry something. He was a politician. He was a senator. Harry Reid. That's right, Harry Reid. When Mitt Romney, who was probably squeaky clean, he was a Mormon. I mean, he just, the worst thing that they said about him was he went on vacation and he put his dog in a car carrier on top of the car. All I'm thinking is my dogs liked it when that air was hitting their face. And so he said Mitt Romney did not pay his taxes. And Romney goes, I most certainly did. I did pay my taxes. But there were enough people that believed that he didn't pay his taxes that he lost that presidential election. And they asked Harry Reid about it. And this is what he said. We won, didn't we? If you're a Christian, That's 1,000,000 miles from where you ought to be. We don't deal in situation ethics, but yet that's what the world does, and we find situation ethics in this parable tonight. And so what is he doing? He has lost his position. He knows that his time is short. The Lord is coming, the Master's coming, and he's going to say, get your things, put them in a box. I want you out of here by 5 o'clock. I mean, that's what's happening. That brings us to the second thing. What action did he take? Look at verse number 3. Then the steward said within himself, he's thinking. Let me tell you something. When you get in a tight, you begin to think hard. It's not fluff. I mean, you're thinking soberly. What shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. He's taken away from me my job. He's taken away from me all of these things that I'm able to get a little bit from here and there. And he said, I cannot dig. Perhaps that means that he is too old to dig. I know this. It was a lot easier for me to use a shovel when I was 30 than it is when I'm 69. Matter of fact, I don't even like using shovels. I've got an auger that I don't really care about using. I got a one-man auger, and I can dig holes. And when we first put that pool in, Deb goes, I want monkey grass everywhere. And I took an auger, and I went around that thing, and I'm going to tell you something. After about 75 or 80 holes, you're ready to throw that thing in the trash. That thing wore me out. Well, here this man is. We don't know how old he is. We just know that he still has a job. He still has a position. And now it's being taken away from him. And he goes, I cannot dig. To beg, I am ashamed. In other words, I have too much pride to stand on a corner and hold a sign that says alms for the poor. Surely I'm not going to have to do that. And so he says that I am resolved what to do when I am put out of the stewardship, that they may receive me into their houses. Now, who is he referencing here? He is referencing the people that owe his Lord, his master, money. Now, let me just back up, and I want to give you a little clarification here. If you look at your notes and if you see the letter B under number 2, it says non-canonical Ecclesiasticus. That is not a mistype. That is not Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiasticus is what is called a non-canonical book. It means it is not in the canon. It is a extra-biblical type book, but some people would read it to try to glean wisdom from it. And in that, it says it's better to die than to beg. And so when you hear that little phrase, non-canonical, don't think that is, you know, something that you can't understand. It's just not, means it's just not in the Bible, all right? Doesn't mean there's not value in it, but it's not inspired the way that the other books are, okay? And so what's his idea? Well, in Jewish culture, Jewish people were not supposed to charge interest to other Jews. Now, you could charge interest to Gentiles all you wanted. But in the Old Testament, you have Exodus 22, Leviticus 25, Deuteronomy 23. All of those are admonitions and commandments that you are not to charge what is called usury. All that word is an old English word, which means you're not supposed to charge interest on fellow Jews. And so, what did they do to circumvent that? Well, if you had someone, and let's say they were buying some, let's just use what they're using here, oil. Olive oil. You would have these measures or we would say gallons of olive oil, and it would cost so much, but then you would charge more for the product because you couldn't charge interest if they charged it on the account. So in other words, if it cost really $400, you charged $800, and you said, it's no interest. They do that exact same thing at Rooms to Go. I mean, I don't know how long ago it's been. I guess it's been 2 years ago now. They ran a special, and next thing you know, we're getting new furniture. We got a new couch. We got a new love seat. We got a new recliner. And it was no interest. I think it's 5 years. And I'm thinking, that's because we're paying for it every month under the total price, even though it says zero interest. You know that. Everybody knows that. But you tell yourself, what a good deal. So you end up paying, you know, a lot more, and you're just simply putting the interest in it. That's what's happening here, all right? It's not that the man owes the 800 that we're going to get to in a moment. He really only owes four, but they're playing the game, and they charge him for eight, and now it's going to be deducted, and it'll get back to kind of the original. And why is he doing that? Because he's trying to gain favor. And so let's look now at verse number 5. And so he called every one of his Lord's debtors. He called him unto him, and he said unto the first, how much owest thou unto my Lord? And verse number 6 says this, 100 measures of oil. Now the measures of oil there, for us, it would probably be about 800 gallons. There are some people say it's 900, but for easy math, we'll just do 800. 800 gallons is how much he had gotten from his master, or from the steward's master. And so that's what he was charged for. Now, he may not have only actually received but 400, but he was charged 800. And so why was he doing that? He was doing that so that the manager's expense could be included in it. But when he's about to lose his job, he's trying to do something to network. He's wanting to be able to go back to this guy's house at some point and let that man bring him in and say, man, you were so good to me. And he's going to let me sit at his table. And so he said, and 100 measures of oil, and he said unto him, take thy bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. So if he owed 800 for 800 gallons of olive oil, if you will pay me right now, 400, we'll wipe the slate clean. That sounded like a great thing. Well, and he said, take thy bill, write it down, and write 50 in verse number 6. Verse 7, he says to another, and how much owest thou? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. So how much is the 100 measures of wheat? Well, we would say that'd be about 900 bushels. That's quite a bit. One of the things that I see when we begin to see these amounts, and we see that this man is an absentee owner, we see that he's pretty wealthy. I mean, he's an absentee owner. Most people that own businesses, they kind of hang out at those businesses. They don't just turn it over, you know, and go to Florida for 6 months unless they are uber wealthy. In other words, they could afford to take a little bit of a loss, and this man is now going to make a reckoning to his or to the manager that has kind of hoodooed him a little bit. And he said, how much do you owe? 100 measures of wheat, about 900 bushels. And he said unto him, take thy bill and write 80. In other words, I want you to write roughly about 700. What does that mean? That means that 200 of those bushels that he had been being charged for was really kind of what the manager was going to take. In other words, it was his quote-unquote commission. And so That's the way that he did it. Now, just because there's only two debtors that he talked about here, I don't think there's any way that it was only two. I think that there were many. These may have been the ones that owed the most. They were the ones that was indebted to the Lord the most. But it was probably more than just that, just with the sheer amount of money that this man probably possessed, the possessions that he had. And so, when we see that, we see now, verse number 8, we see an admiration. Now, it says this, and the Lord commended the unjust steward. One of the reasons that I don't believe that there's a lot of symbolism here is because I just don't believe that Jesus would commend somebody that did wrong. I don't believe that Jesus is happy when people do wrong. Matter of fact, the Bible says in the Old Testament that God is angry with the wicked every day. We don't have a Lord that celebrates sin. In John chapter 8, when Jesus told the woman that had been taken in the act of adultery, he didn't say, "Neither do I condemn thee, go live your life like that again." No, that's not what he said. He said, "Neither do I condemn thee, go and sin no more." In other words, no, that's not the lifestyle that you need to live. Knock it off. And so you have the admiration of this man. And if you'll notice the word Lord, it is lowercase L. It is not an uppercase L. It is a lowercase L. That tells me that this is just some man that had a lot of money that was now firing a steward, but now he's commending the steward. Why? Because it would have been something that he would have probably done himself, because that's what unsaved people do. They seek the best way out that they possibly can. He wasn't happy that he'd gotten ripped off, but he was impressed with the ingenuity of the manager. The manager did not manage right. He was not a good steward, but he was pretty ingenious when it came to the way that he was able to maneuver as he was headed out the door. And, you know, one of the things that I wrote here was he was a smooth operator in the ways of the world. Well, in verse number 9, he says, well, let's back up to verse 8. So the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. Now let that sink in for a moment. Sometimes the people that are unsaved make better financial decisions than God's people. Have you seen that true in your life? I have. There have been many, 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 many people in the world that I know that have been wise when it comes to handling money. And I've known of many, 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 many people that name the name of Christ and they're poor as Job's turkey. Absolutely did not handle it correctly. And so he makes the statement that the children of the world are wiser than the children of light. And I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. In other words, pay attention to what they do, the wise things that they do. Why is that? That when they fail, who's the they? The saved people, the disciples, when they fail, there's some people that think that that word fail there, I'm one of them, they think that the word fail there has the idea of when their heart fails or when they die. So when they die, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. So in other words, the way that they make money, you take money and you deal wisely with it. Why? Because when you die, you basically are going to be going to an everlasting habitation And so you're sending it ahead. If that's the way you want to look at it, and that's the way that I choose to look at it, I love the fact that we can take the mammon or the money that we have, and we can try to give it in the Lord's work and give it to help other people. Why is that? Because one of these days, we will fail. We will die, and we will go to an everlasting habitation. Now, as far as an application, there's a humorous story that I included. It was a lady that was very wealthy, and she died, and she had always heard about the mansions in glory. And she was so looking forward to having her mansion in glory that it was going to be greater than the mansions that she had here on this earth. And as they walked her down through the streets of gold, she saw this beautiful edifice, and she saw that beautiful edifice, and they took her right on the outskirts of town, and there was a little bitty cabin that was there, and they said, "This is yours." And she said, "Well, wait a minute. I thought I was getting a mansion." And they said, "Well, with what you sent forward, this is all we could afford." And so you and I, we have to understand that we need to make application the way that the Lord wants us to handle things, but we need to learn how to handle things sometimes from the children of the world because they have been so good at it for so long. And so you and I, we need to send it on for eternity later. Years ago, there was a television special, and it was about the fall of Jim and Tammy Baker. And I remember watching this, and they were interviewing different people that had invested in, I think it was called the Heritage Center, Heritage Mountain, or something like that. I think it was outside of Charlotte, up in the Smokies somewhere. And this man had given the Bakers and the ministry that they had for one of these cottages that they, or timeshares or whatever it was, had given them something like 100 or 200 grand. And basically he had nothing. Baker had sold those same buildings and same houses like three or four times to three or four different people. And people thought that was theirs and it was going to be something that they could move to and retire to. And when they found out, they didn't have nothing. And they were interviewing this one guy, and I remember what he said. And I'm just thinking, Lord, if that ever happens to me, help me to have this mindset. He said, "How do you feel about losing, you know, the $100,000? And the man said, "Well, I look at it this way. I gave that money in good conscience. I gave that money to God. And so, if it didn't turn out right, it's not because of me, because I did it with right motivations, and I'm okay with it because I did it to God." And I thought, I like that guy. That's a pretty good testimony right there. Now, I don't want to get hoodooed out of 100K. First of all, you got to have it to get hoodooed out of it, but you know, I don't want to get hoodooed out of it if I did have it. But what I'm trying to tell you is this, that we need to be generous in the way that we deal with other people. And we could go back to 1 Peter 4. We will not. But we want to spend now for eternity later. Second thing, look at verse 10 through 12. And we see that we ought to be trustworthy with money. There should never, ever, 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 ever be, a blemish on our testimony when it comes to our finances. I want to make sure that as a preacher that my testimony financially is well. I've had people over the years, especially in the last 9 years, say, why don't you just sign checks? And I'm like, are you nuts? I wouldn't think of signing a check at this church. Why is that? Because I don't want anybody to ever say he signed a check and run off with money. I don't want that to ever happen. Who have we had in that financial office? In the years that I've been here, we've had Miss Hicks, we've had Sandy Dietz, we had Shirley Garman, we had Charlotte MacArthur, we had Miss Pam, and we had Brother Keith. That's six people, and there might have been one or two and another maybe for just a short time, but those are the main six in the last 48 years. Every single one of those six people have a sterling reputation. You know why? Because they were trustworthy. Their lives had been watched. They had a track record of being honest, people of great character. And even when a mistake would be made, you knew that it was not an intentional type thing and it would be corrected. Why? Because their testimony was trustworthy. Verse number 10. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. He that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, in other words, if you've not handled your own money right that you earn with your job, who will commit to your trust the true riches? Where's the true riches? That's in glory. And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? In other words, if you are not faithful when you're working at a job, nobody's going to really trust you when you try to have your own business. It's always, always, always about trust, whether you're handling your money or somebody else's money. And so we have to be trustworthy in the way that we see this. This steward was not trustworthy. I don't think that the Lord himself here, not the Lord Jesus, but the Lord, the Master here, I don't think that he was trustworthy. I think he knew exactly what was going on when it came to those being charged for 800 gallons of olive oil or those 900 bushels of wheat. I think he knew exactly what was happening, and he didn't care. As long as he got what he was supposed to get, it would be like those tax collectors. Rome would say, I need this many denarius. I need this many shekels from those Jews. And then they would try to get more out of it. Why? So they could pad their own pockets. And so I think that that Lord and that steward were two peas in a pod. Verse 13. No man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon or money. You and I, our allegiance first must be to God. No exception. We can't have the attitude, well, I'm gonna work and I'm gonna make all I can make, and then I'll do the will of God when I retire. Can't be that attitude. We have to simply serve the Lord now. We have to not have two masters. I hear people say this all the time. Well, money is the root of all evil. Anybody ever heard that? A few of you. And they go, that's in the Bible. And I'm going, it's not. Loving money is not, or having money is not in the Bible that it's the root of all evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil. Some of the wealthiest people in the world are people that are saints of God. You find Old Testament characters, whether it's Job, whether it's Abraham, whether it's Jacob, later on it'd even be Joseph. Certainly David and Solomon. Saul probably had quite a bit. Solomon had so much that they were making bridles out of gold for horses. I mean, they had gold coming in so much that it's just sitting in corners and not knowing, people don't even know what to do with it. That's the kind of money that Solomon had. And so you've got these Old Testament saints, and they were blessed of God. But when you look at their lives, you find some of them that knew what to do that was right, and some of them that did not know what to do that was right. Job knew what was right. Abraham knew what was right. David knew what was right. Solomon sometimes knew what was right. And so you've got all of these people that had money. But the key is that money doesn't have you. I told one of the men the other day, he and I were talking, and we saw each other, and he said, "I appreciate what you and Debbie did." And basically all we did was just bought them a little lunch. They were sitting over there, and they didn't even know we were there. And so we bought their lunch, and he thanked me for it. And he said, let me give you the money back. I said, no, I don't want that. And he said, "Well, I'm going to give you the money." I said, "Well, I'll pass it along." And I said, "I've told this from the pulpit. There's been probably tens of thousands of dollars, maybe even hundreds of thousands, that I've been responsible for and come through these hands. And I thank God that none of it stuck." And that's the way that the Lord needs to have us, not things. And I hope that's your mindset as well. And so one final thing, and I hope that you'll really hold on to this and maybe circle it in your Bible. Look at verse 14. Now, we already read it once because we saw that the Pharisees, they were covetous, and they heard all these things that he had preached in chapter 15, and now he's preaching and has preached about the unjust steward. But I want you to notice it says they derided him. The last little phrase there, they derided him. The Greek word for derided has to do with the nose. And right in the middle of that, it's the little root of that word where it's they turned their nose up at him. They sneered. I mean, it's almost like, who does he think he is? That's the reason that he taught parables. Because the unsaved people just did not get it. And so you have them deriding, turning their nose up at the Lord. They'll say things like this. You might have family and friends that are close to you. What do you mean you give most Sundays? What do you mean you give to missions? Well, why did you send that Christian school money? Why did you give that evangelist something? Why did you help that poor person? You know they're going to be back wanting more. Why did you do that? And they berate you for basically trying to do right. Don't let that be your influence. Take this unjust steward. Take the commendation that the unjust owner gave him and just be wise with what the Lord's given to you. The great John Wesley said this. He said, make all you can, save all you can, give all you can. And that's it. Make it, save it, give it. That ought to be the attitude that we Christians have. We ought to be a generous people. Why? Because we are stewards in the Lord's work. The same way that this guy was thinking hard, how am I going to be able to save my bacon? How am I going to be able to save my mutton? He didn't eat bacon. How am I going to be able to save that lamb chop? The only way I can do it, I got to be smart. Hey, I'm going to give you a discount, but I'm about to run into a little bit of trouble. Now, I'm going to come to your house, and I want you to just, you know, help me out. And I need to talk to you. Do you know anybody that needs some help? This is what my qualifications are. And they're talking about all this, and whether it's the oil, whether it's the wheat, whatever it is, he's working that network. Well, we Christians, we ought to learn from those types of things, and we ought to be wise the same way that sometimes the children of the world are wise. But we do it with this in mind, that God is my master and he's first. Well, I hope that as we looked at this tonight, that maybe it gave you a little different perspective maybe than you've looked at.